ability in any educational institution is crazy making for the rest of their colleagues, crazy making for students. It's a terrible formula for education. The third issue we would go on strike for is they really want to gut our contract of all sorts of rights we've had historically in co-governance of the institution, decision making, educators making educational decisions. Yeah, we'll go to the mat for that, to keep that. And also past practices, which are a huge issue in any workplace. They just want a zipper clause to eliminate all past practices.
So PSU professors, you've been organized since 1978, but you've never been on strike.
That's correct.
And but somehow the negotiations are different. Some's happened with the administration. What's changed?
My sense is what's changed, we have top management now that has exhibited a level of hubris and overall disrespect for the people who make the institution that, in a sense, has served us well because it was a wake-up call for all of us. In past rounds of negotiation, we could talk to people across the table. Many of them had come up through the ranks, so they knew what the institution was like. We could disagree, but there was a semblance of conversation among colleagues, even though they were management. That's no longer the case. So it's allowed us to disabuse ourselves of certain myths about how higher education works. It's been becoming a kind of corporate form of organization for the best of three decades, but kind of our class identity, let's say, has been lagging. And right now they have left nothing to the imagination. They don't negotiate. They've tried to gut our contract, and they've offered pay cuts, more instability, and fewer rights. And not once have they paused to even try and explain why those are educationally sound proposals. Their attitude has always been, we're proposing it because we can.
Brother Fairchild, in the case of the city, what's different in these negotiations from previous years? What's new this time around, or what's changed?
Well, let me go back to 2001, when the last time that the DCTU went on strike, when they went on their six-hour strike. At that time, Mayor Katz felt like it was basically the contention was over healthcare at that time. And Mayor Katz felt like that we did not have the support of the community or the backbone to actually carry out the strike. As soon as we did, she recognized that they were no way prepared as far as doing the critical and dedicated services that we provide to the city of Portland. In the next administration, Tom Potter recognized that, and he basically rolled the contract over. He saw that the services we provide were critical for the stability of the city. In the next administration, even as the economy was starting to turn and Mayor Sam Adams was in office, he also honored the contract. We went into bargaining. We changed a few things, but it wasn't nearly as contentious or disrespectful as this current bargaining. Actually, we've been bargaining now for over 13 months. Currently, it's certainly my opinion, but I feel like that the current administration disrespects the work that we do, and they don't recognize that we are very dedicated and highly skilled workers that maintain all infrastructure within the city.
So back to you, Brother Padin. You've mobilized professors this year like never before. Talk about that, and what about the rank and file involvement in this struggle, and what have you seen in so far in far as professors changing their views and the confidence that they're expressing in their demands?
So our faculty and our academic professionals are very highly mobilized right now, and this is, as you know, historically unprecedented. We haven't been very mobilized in the past, in part because we never understood the importance of being mobilized, and also because we always felt that our bargaining team was getting whatever they were getting for us as a result of their smarts and their charts and all of that. And this year we realized that the bargaining team representing educators at PSU would get creamed unless we mobilized. And I'd say we had a reach in terms of organizer lingo, of 7% going into the new year in September, and we have a reach of about 75% in a face-to-face network. We had about 800 people show up at the strike authorization vote, and we had an overwhelming majority vote for it, 94%. And we're organizing right now, spring break this week, a strike camp. We're ready to go to the end. We're mobilized this time.
Brother Fairchild, in the case of DCTU and city workers, your local 483, does have a reputation as being a rank and file and militant union. You're also in a coalition, as you said, with seven unions in DCTU, and different unions have different cultures, different contexts. How well is this coalition holding together? How strong is the solidarity within the group? And has the mobilization at the rank and file level or of some of the unions gotten everybody ready to strike? Are people ready to go?
I think that's been one of the fascinating things about this entire process, John, is that the DCTU is a 7-member trade union with ASME and Labor's 483 being two of the largest unions. ASME has about 700. We have about 600 members. And because of that, we've had different issues that we have fought at the bargaining table for. So there's been some difficulty just amongst rank to come into the same clarity as far as what we all want. The bargaining team finally brought a TA to the table over a month ago, thinking the best way to do a poll of their membership was to bring a TA and let the membership vote. What was fascinating about that is that anyone on the bargaining team, any officer in the union, or any representation of the union has to recommend the yes vote. And at that time, members of 483, which you do say is a little more militant than some of the others, were outraged that, number one, what the TA stood for. We felt like there was so many compromises that we couldn't accept, that we as a rank and file went out in the community and in our union and the other unions of the DCTU and promoted why we needed a no vote on this TA. We succeeded, which did two things. Number one, it totally empowered 483 laborers, but it also showed the other members of the DCTU that we were willing to fight for what we felt was right. We went back to the bargaining table. The city brought their last best almost 30 days ago. We're almost through with our 30-day cooling off period. And it was an insult to the membership of the DCTU and the citizens of this community. We then proceeded to have our vote to either accept or reject it. Labor's 43 rejected it by 95%. The next week, ASME rejected it by like 92%. So through this empowerment, we now have very strong coalition, very strong support, both within our membership, but also within the greater outside community and supporting unions. And we are ready now to hold the city accountable and ask them to give us a fair and just contract.
And just to clarify a little bit of our jargon, TA is tentative agreement for anyone who doesn't know what that means. Okay.
So back to you, Brother Padin. The American Association of University Professors has stated that the faculty's teaching conditions are the students' learning conditions. Can you talk a little bit about what that means in this particular fight, and what would you say is the state of student faculty solidarity? Do you feel like the students are taking this as their own fight?
Okay. Well, that slogan, teaching conditions are the students' learning conditions, is a very powerful one. And clearly, we've taken a page from the struggle of the teachers in Chicago. And this is the case of a slogan that has nothing rhetorical about it. It is solid. It is substantive. I'll give you two concrete examples that show how teaching conditions translate into learning conditions. One is we have not only at Portland State University, but that's where we have some power to change things, but we have higher education all over the place nationally treating students as customers, not as learners, and that means there are really no ethical scruples that stand between you and how you treat them except getting their tuition dollars. You polish a brand name and you take their money in return for what seems like education. We have fads like online education where students get fewer and fewer and fewer contacts with their instructors, but they're cash cows. And our administration doesn't stop to think of its impact on our students. Those are worsening teaching conditions and worsening learning conditions. Also in our contract, what we've received as offers from management. They want a more unstable teaching force. Students who don't know if their teachers are going to be there next term or the following term can't get mentoring, can't get letters of recommendation. In fact, if those teachers are really shuttling between 3 and 4 workplaces, they can't even see them after class. They just have a very stressed and harried set of teachers, and that's just not good for education, and students realize that. Now, you ask me, what's the state of student-faculty solidarity? It is huge. That's also very new. This is a wonderful generation, and we're seeing in K through 12 and in universities a new student movement, and they're giving the struggle together with us for what we believe is a fundamental right of all citizens, which is the right to free and universal education. And it's becoming further and further away from free and universal education. It's becoming costly, it's becoming deceptive, and it's not ethical.
I know that there was a big rally on February 27th. Can you talk a little bit about that and what happened there and what you hope to do to build solidarity with the larger Portland community?
Well, at that rally, we had an info picket, a dress rehearsal, as it were, for a real picket, anticipating that we might have to go on strike. That was February 27th. And we had 350 of our members from AUP come out in the morning. It was one of those just real dreary days in the Willamette Valley. It was raining so hard, I said, my God, no one's going to come out. But we called it for 11. I got there about 5 minutes before 11, and there was already 350 people. Ours, 15 minutes later, over 700, between 700 and 800 students walked out. They had a walkout. They organized it on their own, and they came out, and we occupied those park blocks for 2 hours. We had colleagues, part-time faculty organized by AFT out there, SEIU colleagues from Portland State University there, Jobs with Justice. We had the Portland Association of Teachers. So that's a good segue into your last question, which is what type of solidarity are we building? We have an external solidarity committee. We've been talking to our colleagues and unions across the city, and we're getting a lot of support wherever we go. I think particularly the labor movement had been waiting way too long to see universities to wake up and stand up.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 in Portland. This is Labor Radio. We're talking with Jose Padin with the Portland State University professors and Scotty Fairchild with the City Workers Union.
You can also catch this show and others archived at that same website. This is going to be automatically recorded, so if you have a friend who missed the show, should hear it, direct them to the website to listen later.
The website is kboo.fm.
That's correct, Jamie. Scotty Fairchild, in terms of the laborers' struggle in the wider community, Local 483 has taken some strong stands in connection with other struggles, for example, the Occupy encampment, the Right to Dream 2 rest area. In terms of the present moment, how are you framing your struggle for a fair contract to connect with the people of Portland more widely?
Well, to begin with, I'm very proud to be associated with those other organizations that you mentioned. One thing that I think labor unions need to do more of is to reach out in the community and take support and action within other struggles where other people are being impacted. How we're taking our message, we are similar to the Portland Association of Teachers, Association of Professors at Portland State. We are part of the community. We don't feel like we're outside the community. We are part of this community. We serve the community, and we're dependent on by this community. So we're taking our struggle out to the people of Portland and letting them know of the services that we provide, the passion that we have in providing other services, and how one of our main goals is to make this city a better place to live and to raise kids through our schools, maintain the city clean, safe, and prosperous. So we feel like, you know, the total community is our ally and is there to, you know, support us.
Maybe there should be a slogan similar to teachers' working conditions or students' learning conditions, that workers' austerity is also citizens' austerity in the case of the city workers. Huh? How about that?
That would be great. Okay. That'd be great.
Whose city?
Our city.
City.
That's right.
Whose university?
Our university.
Whose schools?
Yeah. So, Jose Padin, As for the bigger picture, how does this contract campaign fit into the big struggles facing public higher education today?
Well, the big struggle facing higher education, I think, is the big struggle facing working people and the big struggle facing citizens. And you noted the term austerity, and it is that everything public is being gutted and then marketized and corporatized. And we have to turn this around. The rights, the social rights of citizens in our society are rapidly disappearing. And we want to put the public back into our public university. We want to put public back into public higher education, the public into the running of our public schools, our public services, and so on. And at the university, it's kind of doubly egregious when it comes to working people, because what we have is corporate administrations that take the money of one group of working people, our working students, they all work, and they use it to fight the working people who are trying to educate them. That's an insane design for education.
And Scotty Fairchild, in terms of the city workers, we've mentioned contracting out, we've mentioned austerity. We probably should add temporary work to the list of things that are typical of a neoliberal economy. So how would you relate this particular struggle to that wider context in terms of public sector workers?
Well, I think as we're seeing all over the country, John, is that public sector workers, whether it's in our school systems, in our people providing services on the ground, there are constantly under attack by both the corporate sector, but also now we're seeing it from, you know, our public governments. I think the Wisconsin struggle was a great wake-up call to see how no one is you know, immune from being under attack from this kind of management philosophy. What we are finding that one of the best things we can do is continually to build these strong partnerships amongst the public sector, amongst other trade unions, but probably most importantly amongst the community. Because as I said before, we are all in this together as community members. And if we let one part of our society go into privatization, especially if it goes to a company that has no interest in what's happening in our community, they're maybe in, you know, a Denver or, you know, a Waco, Texas, who starts managing our systems, we basically lost control of those systems. I think it's critical that we maintain those.
Or they might sell some parking meters that are based on a corrupt deal and don't necessarily perform up to snuff, huh?
That's correct. And we've had grievances, which we have won. And that's one of the things that when we go back to the city at the bargaining table, we can point out when they've tried to contract out our jobs, there has always been trouble.
Well, we still got a few minutes left. I'd like to offer Brother Pradeen a few more little time to for any final words you'd like to leave with our listeners about your struggle there at PSU.
I'd just like to thank John and Jamie and Cable and Labor Radio and all of our partners in the community for standing together with us. It's very inspiring. We're facing not only a Portland state, but kind of in our society as a whole, just widening inequalities that are tearing our communities apart. And our struggle at Portland State University is a struggle between the 1%, because our top 32 administrators, who are making an average of $197,000 a year, they're in the 1% very clearly, and they're dishonestly taking the money of our students, and they're trying to impose pay cuts and worsening working conditions for the folks who work there. That's not tolerable. The quality of life in any community is a function of how unequal or equal it is. And we've had enough in this country. We really have to roll it back.
And Scotty, what can you tell us we should watch for in coming weeks as far as the DCTU contract battle, and how can people plug in to be in solidarity with you?
Well, first, John, let me thank you both for like, you know, hosting this show. I think it's a great show, and I think, you know, Jose has really put the, you know, fist down as far as what the issues are within our, you know, our communities. We do have to stand up, and I think that one of the ways that our struggles are going on is that everyone in this community has a voice. And sometimes we don't use our voices. We think someone else is going to use them for us. We have something better to do. I think in these cases now, it's time for the citizens of Portland to stand up, use their voice, demand that these services within Portland Public Schools, within Portland State University, with city workers are provided by the skilled, dedicated people who have been doing them. Call up the city council. Call up people who you know in the business community and let them know what your desires are. And I think that's one way that we can build this into a much stronger and richer community.
Scott, is there a particular number or website that people can plug into if they want to be part of the solidarity campaign with the city workers?
Well, both the DCTU has a website, dctu.org. The Laborers has a website. LIUNA 483, LUINA, has a website. I know AFSCME has a website. And I think that if you link to any of those, then you can start to wander through, you know, all of the links, and you can find out what the issues are.
Great. And on your side at the PSU with the professors, how can folks plug into the Solidarity campaign?
There's a number of ways, but I'm just going to provide a couple of web addresses because a lot of the information is always put there by our wonderful communications people. We have one campaign website, wearepsu.org. Real easy. wearepsu.org. And the other one is just Google PSU AUP Facebook, and it'll take you to that Facebook page. And if you like it, I hope you like it because you like us and you like the idea of Portland State University remaining Portland's university and not corporate university. But if you like us, you're going to get constant reminders of things coming up, press pieces, actions, and so on. So those two websites.
Is there a particular decision maker that people should call or write letters or email with their opinion about settling this contract?
Yeah, that would be good. And we will be posting a number of emails up in the wearepsu.org. It would be good if anyone who's concerned about taking back our university and taking it away from these absentee managers, that you write the president of Portland State University and you copy Governor Kitzhaber, Tim Nesbitt, and the chairs of the higher education committees in the Senate and the House in Salem. But I can't give you all of those email addresses over the air. You will find the information on our website, and you'll copy it to our campaign email. And it seems like these narcissists who run our institutions really don't care while it's inside ball, but the moment other people outside start showing concern about the way they're mismanaging our institutions, they start budging a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Jamie, I think Jobs with Justice is involved in this too somehow. Do you have some information there?
Yeah, I do. I have an announcement about a workers' rights board, a public hearing on defending quality higher education working conditions and learning conditions at Portland State University. And this is coming up on April 3rd, Thursday, April 3rd, from 7 to 9 p.m. on the PSU campus at the Native American Student and Community Center. It's sponsored by Portland Jobs with Justice. It's called a Workers' Rights Board hearing, and some of the Workers' Rights Board panel members are State Senator Michael Devereaux, former State Senator Avril Gordley, Pastor David Wheeler, and State Representative Jennifer Williamson, who will respond to testimony from PSU students, faculty, and staff. So if you can make it to that hearing, Thursday, April 3rd, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Native American Student Center at Portland State University, defending quality higher education. Also had another labor-related announcement that our listeners might be interested in. On this Wednesday, the 26th of March at 9 a.m. in front of City Hall, the 15 Now campaign is kicking off a visibility effort. That's for those who may be familiar, the Fight for 15, for a $15 minimum wage. The campaign is kicking off here in Portland. So 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. a visibility rally in front of City Hall for 15 Now on Wednesday. That's the 26th of March. And that about wraps it up for our program. Labor Radio, this tonight, Monday night, and every Monday night.
We want to say thank you to both our guests and to all the sisters and brothers in the unions from which they come, and wish them well in their struggle. Also, thanks to Danielle, the engineer for this show.
And thank you, Scotty Fairchild from Laborers 483 and Jose Padin with the American Association of University Professors at Portland State University. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
And good night.
Good night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening, this is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. I recently met with Steve Berger, Director of Washington County Community Corrections, to discuss Washington County's plans for its justice reinvestment funds. This fund was created through the passage of House Bill 3194, Oregon's first major prison reform in decades. House Bill 3194 flatlined prison growth for 5 years, reduced some sentences, and extended transitional leave. These reforms saved millions of dollars that were then reinvested in Oregon counties. Now it's up to Oregon counties to provide programs and treatment in their communities with the expectation that it will help reduce prison intakes and lower recidivism. Steve Berger discussed how Washington County will spend the almost $1.3 million it received from the Justice Reinvestment Fund.
In Washington County, we put together a full continuum of response to take a look at how we're going to supervise these offenders in the community, primarily the short-term trans-leave offenders that are coming from prison and those that are being sentenced to the community. We put together what we call an integrated reentry intensive supervision and services program. We cut it short and we call it IRIS. The IRIS program consists of 2 probation and parole officers, 2 recovery mentors, an employment specialist, special contracted services for substance abuse treatment, increased resources for mental health assessments and medications, urine testing, clean and sober housing, and flex funds for subsidy services that don't meet some of the traditional categories that we just mentioned.
We want to say that this information is specific to Washington County, and each county in Oregon will spend its House Bill 3194 funding differently.
Yes, consistent with the Community Corrections Act and the principles behind local control, the idea was to pass these funds to the local jurisdictions and allow them to develop programs and services that fit with their local community's values, their continuum of services, to make sure that it was a local investment, not just an outside program that was trying to have one size fits all.
Each county in Oregon is a little different. So what is the Washington County Community Corrections? What does that comprise of?
Washington County Community Corrections is responsible for the operation of a 215-bed work release facility, and we are also responsible for the community supervision of nearly 3,600 offenders in the community under supervision on parole, post-prison supervision, and probation.
So how did Washington County determine where these funds should be spent?
The process was a collaborative one, primarily through our local public safety coordinating council, where we were able to develop the IRIS program with input from local service providers, the district attorney's office, the sheriff's office, and the county administrator's office, and the courts.
And there were other funds that the Washington County Jail or the sheriff's office received also?
Yes. Statewide, the state allocated $5 million for local jails to provide them the opportunity to collaborate with community corrections and see how they could enhance those services. And in Washington County, the sheriff received about $430,000. And the Sheriff's Office, in partnership with the IRIS program, is allocating services for a mentor for the male population, housing, employment services, enhanced electronic home detention services. They also have a jail TV scroll of information about programming, transition, and resource information. And they also are working with DMV to secure state-issued identification prior to inmates' release from the local jail as well. There's really two sources of revenue for the 3194. There's the $15 million statewide that was allocated to community correction programs, and then there was the $5 million that was allocated to local jails. The grant allocation model follows the same allocation as the community corrections grant and aid funds. So, for example, in Washington County, our grant and aid funding formula calculates out at about 8.61% of the statewide pool. And so the justice reinvestment funds that were available through House Bill 3194 were distributed based upon that same percentage, 8.61.
And that was based on, I understand, the number of felons from the county, is that correct?
Correct. It's not a demographic based upon the entire population of Washington County. It's specifically tied to the number of felony offenders under supervision in Washington County and that percentage of the statewide pool.
So what were some of the changes along with this Justice Reinvestment Fund, the reforms of House Bill 3194?
Well, I'm probably not the best person to speak to the law changes, but what I am generically aware of is there were some sentencing changes relating to marijuana, specifically that there's probation instead of a prison sentence for some felony marijuana cases. I believe there was also some changes to the driving while suspended crimes, an offender to be placed on probation instead of the original prison time. I think there were some changes in the Rob 3s and identity theft, and there might be some judicial discretion on drug delivery and manufacture. The biggest change that the Community Corrections is actively involved with is the increase in the short-term transitional leave. Prior to the last legislative session, short-term trans leave had been reduced to about 30 days, and this new piece of legislation increased the short-term trans leave back to where we were in earlier years, and it now grants a 90-day transitional